Welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance Podcast. I'm Greg Schinkel, President of Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems. And you know our mandate here is to give you some actionable ideas to help you accelerate some of the projects that you may be leading, make you a better leader, and give you more professional growth that helps you on your career path. And this episode is brought to you by our LEAP program, Leadership Excellence Application Program. It's something that we do after we deliver our live training sessions that adds to the sustainability of the results for your people. So it extends the training longer to make a bigger impact. Now, today, my guest is someone who I've known for 20 years, but we haven't actually seen each other and talked in the last 10 years. And so let me tell you a little bit about our guest. Lauren Gerard was the president and general manager of a large window and door company that was a client of ours where we had done some frontline leadership. And I'd met with Lauren and we did small projects on and off for about 10 years. He has a very extensive manufacturing background. We were just chatting about that before starting the episode. And I've asked him in because I've always admired the way that he ran his business and he conducted himself. And it was a pleasure to do business with him, pleasure to interact with him. And so I'm so glad that he's here in the studio. Join me in welcoming Lauren Gerard. Lauren, welcome.
Well, thank you for being here.
Yeah. So, Lauren, the one thing that, and I was just fawning over you in the before we started recording, and the one reason why you've been on my mind, even though we haven't talked in 10 years, is just because you made such an impression on me going back to all the encounters that we had doing business. And you probably didn't even realize that, which means that there's been other people that you've also had that kind of impact on, right? A lasting legacy. I was always curious, though. I mean, we can jump into your sort of current and lasting philosophies about leadership, but I'm curious about your journey of how you got your philosophies about leadership. Can we go back in time? Because I'm not sure, when I met you, you might have been mostly enlightened already, but I didn't know how you got to that state with some of the things you believed in. Do you mind sharing that, some of that journey?
Okay. I guess I'd always just had an innate desire to help people. I enjoyed being around people. And I always tried to educate myself by listening to other people. Mm-hmm. I also was an incessant reader, and I had observed in a part of my career in a real small town in northern Ontario, and I happened to actually go out with a girl, a date, and her father was the president of a big company, a mining company, and I got to meet him, and I thought, you know, there's a point in my life where I'd really like to have that kind of a role in business. Mm-hmm. And so I took it upon myself to start my education, and I just started reading books on leadership, on negotiating skills, anything I could get my hands on, biographies. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I still do pretty much that. I've read, like, you know, John Maxwell, Napoleon mm-hmm. Hill, Andrew Carnegie, mm-hmm. and most recently, Dr. Jordan Peterson, mm-hmm. People I admire. Yeah. And they explore with you and take you down routes that you hadn't thought about before. Yeah. And gave me a plan that, because leadership, in my opinion, is a learned skill. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that what I was going to try and do in my life was set a role for myself and learn through it and learn the acumen of leadership.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good, because now I have this faint memory from way back in one of our earliest encounters after my dad and I had wrote our book, Employees Not Doing What You Expect. And I think you actually either had a copy or you bought a couple of copies for your library.
Yes.
And you're right. That was probably one of the first things that, now that you say that, I remember you actually had a very extensive leadership library. So it was an honor to have a book inside the library. So you told us a little bit about how you did it, which is just you're a lifelong learner. You like to absorb a lot of things. What are a couple of the philosophies or things that really stuck with you around how you interacted with people? Because I was going to say to our audience that really every time I met with Lauren, he made you feel special and it was important. You were important to him. So anyway, I just wondered how you, or what your philosophies were.
Well, you've nailed it. The most appreciable asset in any company is the people. And I needed to spend time with them, getting to know them. But you have to get to their level. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is to integrate with them and talk to them, not in a down way, not as the boss. Find out their interests and what their visions are and what they want to accomplish in their life. And I used to make it as a point for even in the last place that I would know the employee's wife's name. So if I met him in a social environment, I couldn't stumble away. I stumbled as it was anyway, but I did my best to try and at least remember something. And there's always something unique about each of the individuals. And it was very fun to me. I just enjoyed it, getting to know the lattice work of what made up our whole congregation of people.
Right.
And it also helped me to formulate strategy relative to what's important to the group, mm-hmm. and then be able to encircle that in a vision and cast mm-hmm. that vision and get it. So, you know, leadership is people who will follow you even when they're not obligated to.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that was the key element of what my focus was. Mm-hmm. And I just enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed greeting them coming in.
That's one thing I was going to observe is that frequently at the window and door company, which is where I had worked with you, you would have said, I was here, at 6 a.m. or 5:30 or 6:30 and greeting people on the way in. Or on the flip side, greeting people on the way out and thanking them for a good day's work. So again, that was just all part of your people first mindset? Right.
Yes.
Okay.
It was all that. That's exactly what it was. I wanted them to know that I wasn't in an ivory tower.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd worked in companies where that ivory tower was very obvious to me. And I didn't enjoy it even as a senior manager in there.
It felt just distant?
The distance and the non-accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
I had a phone on the shop floor and a direct line to my office.
Oh, wow. And that was, of course, before the days of everyone having a cell phone.
That's right.
So they could reach you if they needed to. I think that's like the bat phone almost. They could call
because
you.
We did have controlled entry and designated areas where we didn't want people going.
Right.
And so they couldn't get into the office, but 99 times out of 100, I wasn't there anyway.
Right. And you were on the floor.
Yeah, I was on the floor.
Or meeting with people.
Or meeting in other people's offices. Yeah. I didn't like meeting in my office very much.
Okay, interesting. So when I think of, only recently we're kind of doing a deeper dive as a company into trying to help manufacturing companies take like soft skills over here and operational excellence and lean over here and mm-hmm. trying to make them integrate more than they typically are. But one of the things in looking back at the Toyota production system that everyone focuses on from a lean and continuous improvement, a lot of people skip over the fact that one of the cornerstones is respect.
Correct.
And what you're demonstrating here is that it's really the respect for people. It's not about titles. It's not about their position. And in fact, the folks that you made it a point to relate to were the folks adding value to the product and getting it out to the customer.
That's right.
And at least for a long time in your mandate, you were growing fairly consistently and fairly rapidly, as I remember, expansions and things. And I don't know whether you have any specific insights. What was it like to grow rapidly? Because you'd probably been in other businesses that had more sort of either measured growth or ups and downs. And then you were on quite a winning streak there for quite some time. What was it like to manage a rapidly growing company?
Well, it was rapidly growing, but the thing I did recognize right from the onset, because of past experience in another rapidly growing company, mm-hmm. and they self-imploded.
Mm.
And I said, I made up my mind that wasn't going to happen where I was. And so I controlled it right down to the point where I had to tell the salesman not to bring me any more business.
Oh, wow.
Because the destruction that goes on with taking on too much and not being able to deliver just ruins your reputation.
Yeah.
And I'd seen that firsthand.
Right.
So I was very firm about it and said, here is our, we're going to do everything we have to do to improve our operation, to improve its efficiency, to improve our quality, mm-hmm. the value we give to our customers, the service we give to our customers. We cannot compromise any of those value systems for any purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so I constantly said, let's take the business and let's maximize our profitability and do that instead of having it descend in the reverse, you know, building more and making less.
Right.
That I wasn't interested in doing that.
Right. I think you established the company for having a great record of quality, warranty, customer service, right? So that was important because you knew that if you strayed too far away from that, it was eventually becomes a downward spiral.
It's a core value, and yet you need to have a focus on, and you need to be the champion of. And it makes sometimes the decisions are difficult to do that.
Yeah, and I think when you're making a difficult decision that might be perceived at least as a negative to a specific individual impacted by that decision, if they know that in your core values that you really do care, then they understand that the intent behind it is not personal or negative.
No.
It's about the health of the business. So a lot, I know that if you've read a lot, you've read definitely a lot about servant leadership, which
yes,
it certainly seems that you were demonstrating that.
Thank you.
I'm curious because, you know, having worked with some of your supervisors, they didn't always know that. They weren't always indoctrinated the same way, right? So what would you tell people about what it means to be a servant leader wherever you are in the organization?
Okay. I guess part of that, what I did when I took over the organization was I created and wrote the mission statement for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And the policy and procedure manuals. And it was a daunting task. And I also became the gatekeeper of those things.
Mm.
So I went through with every employee and sat down and found out what they did for a living as a job, because we didn't have any job descriptions, and wrote them. And
so you wrote them based on what people told you they were actually doing.
Right.
And got it to a baseline of agreement that that's what should
be
going.
Okay. Yes. And then
I didn't realize that, by the way, that you see people pay lip service, I think, sometimes to mission statements and even SOPs and job descriptions.
Right.
And you're saying, hey, these are the tools available to document it, but I'm not going to sit in my office and write them.
No.
Or get AI to write them, which is probably what's happening these days. It's like, I'm going to go and actually document the truth. And if there's multiple versions of the truth, let's agree on which version is probably the best.
Yes. And it also helped me find out where there was so much isolation that we didn't have any cross-training in the organization.
Mm.
And I thought that was a handicap as opposed to an advantage. And so I didn't want to threaten the employees. It wasn't about taking away their jobs. It was about finding out what they were doing. And it really came up as necessity, because one day the accountant wasn't in.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I need some documentation.
Yeah.
Well, nobody knows where it is or who it is or how to do the work. So we did that, and at that time we were pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
We were about 30 employees at that time.
How large did the business get?
It was over 450 when I left.
Yeah, which is, you know, I think anybody listening to the podcast can realize what happens when you go from 30 to 450 over whatever period of time, and just all the potential problems, like you said, in growth.
Yeah.
So I think anybody who has aspirations to grow rapidly needs to pay attention to the fact that you have to build a very strong foundation in order to do that.
That's correct. And that's what I was doing, was trying to lay that groundwork. I mean, we even had employees who couldn't speak English.
Yeah, I remember that. I was going to bring that up, that you had a very, like, even some of the supervisors struggled a little bit with it sometimes around literacy. And I remember you always, you know, helping me understand that since we were doing the training, is remember that these guys are not going to be able to read like lots of things. So it's about discussion. It's about their experiences and pulling it out. So that was a special challenge in the work group, right? That you were, you would hire people who really had some literacy challenges, or at least language challenges.
Yeah, maybe. Language challenges. I, most of those I inherited, but they were continued on into the future because that group of people was large, and they obviously talked to each other and say, come to work here. It's a great place to work.
Right.
And we actually conducted English classes at night. I hired he was actually a minister, but he could speak the main language and he could speak English, and we would come in and conduct English lessons.
Yeah, neat.
And then we did the same thing with computer training.
Yeah.
As we evolved with more automation, which I was just incessantly crazy about driving.
Well, actually, since you brought up automation, I did want to come up. And also just I'm going to say, given that you read lots of leadership books, always did, you had to see the newfangled tools that were coming down, whether it was, I say newfangled, but it's been around for a long time, like lean and continuous improvement and automation and technology. And I'm thinking, at the same time as you're very people-centered, how did you view these things that were there as potential tools? And actually, because, I watched you automate your business to obviously to handle the higher volumes and not have to constantly increase the number of headcount, as you increase sales. That's one of the keys. But what was your view of these different, sometimes they were fads, sometimes they were useful. How did you sort all that out to figure out what to do around things like automation, technology, that sort of thing?
Well, the industry at that point in time, from an automation perspective, was in its infancy.
Oh, okay.
And
so it was a very labor-intensive industry generally.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah. Even previously in my other career, when I worked in another company, one of the things I did take on and champion was Japanese manufacturing techniques and Kaizen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd had some background, at least theoretically, in doing it. But I also had a very good contact who was into robotics for the automotive industry, and I brought him in, and we started brainstorming.
Mm-hmm.
And we developed automation that had never been open to the industry before, and created a furor. And because the word on the street at that point was, well, they're crazy, they're never going to work, and they'll go broke.
Mm.
And that never happened.
Right.
But I knew that.
In fact, if anything, it probably allowed you to expand margins after you got it working well.
Absolutely.
Right? So you're willing to take the chance on technology. This is also another sign of any innovator is when your competition says, "Oh, they're crazy," or "They're selling below my cost." Well, guess what? Their costs are probably lower. And now there is the bleeding edge and there's the leading edge.
Yes.
But you developed, I guess, the capability and probably did some experiments, some that worked well and some that didn't, and you just kept at it.
Yeah.
So it sounds like.
Yeah. We just committed ourselves, and the owner gave me a free hand.
Mm.
Once we had the company on the track of what business we were in, which I had to get sorted out, what our core values were going to be built on, and we started to produce product where we didn't advertise, and that was consciously done because I wanted to create a word. Our reputation by word of mouth,
right.
and then we started getting the door knocking from dealers wanted to buy.
And you treated your dealers quite well,
yes.
Because you viewed them as partners,
correct?
Especially if you're not doing a lot of direct to consumer marketing,
right?
So this brings me to like relationships.
Yes.
All right. So you manage relationships up too, because like you said, you got the owner to buy in, and owners, I know I am one, owners have these proclivities that sometimes they mess with things that are working or they don't understand some things, but you really gained that trust.
Yes.
Then you built relationships. Well, you already had relationships with your team, your employees, but you then viewed relationships with your dealers. And I was a supplier of training, right? And you always insisted on us having these face-to-face discussions, which, of course, back 20 years ago, that was totally normal. You'd go and see people, although still not as much as you probably should. And these days we're getting even further and further away from that. I can't remember how many real sales calls there are anymore.
Yeah.
But you insisted on us getting together. So what was your view of just in general the relationships, managing them up, sideways, I guess, different ways? And even why did you insist on, you know, conversations in person, which weren't really that lengthy as I remember, mm-hmm. but they were impactful?
Yeah, I guess I had one mantra. At this company, we're going to do something unusual. We're going to talk to each other. And I hated sending me email right. when I was in the same building.
Yeah.
I just
come and see me, or let's have a discussion. Yeah.
That's why I put the phone on the shop, yeah. and I'm on the floor 80-90% of the day.
Right.
So bump into me if it's private, we'll find a room to sit down, or I'll come to you, or come to the office. But we need to talk. Mm-hmm. And the same reason why I like to meet in other people's office. Once I thought something was back on the ropes, mm-hmm. I could leave. Okay. Whereas if they were in my office, I had to throw them out. I didn't want to go that route.
Well, then I'm thankful that we had the meetings at your office. So you just knew that, and this is important because communication has been one of the things that people always say. And one of my colleagues who's going to be a guest on the podcast, Bob Parker, said, I hate writing communication as the reason for a problem because it's just such a big topic. But what you were really espousing was let's just talk to each other. Like if there's a problem, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
Even if it's difficult, let's talk about it. Maybe even more so, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And it didn't mean that there weren't some hard decisions to make, but when you're face to face, you can kind of read people as to are we on the same page here or not.
Yeah.
So you stuck with that.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And I also gained a lot of experience when I had worked in another company as a labor relations manager.
Oh.
And so I spent a lot of time negotiating contracts.
Right.
And I just said, like, why is it that we are talking at this time when we're working full time? Why aren't we talking to each other every day?
Right.
And then I'd have to deal with a business agent on their side or a right. lawyer on their side.
Yeah.
And I detested that with a passion.
Because it was a third party interfering in our relationships.
That's correct.
Thing? Okay.
Yeah. So I said, like, the only way that you can stand before the people and communicate with them, and when we did in General Assembly, was because you talk to them all the time, and they're going to believe what you're talking to them mm-hmm. about, because there's trust, there's integrity, there's value systems that we share.
Mm-hmm.
There's success that what we've done in the organization has manifested itself in a better paycheck for them and better working conditions. So you can't do that in an ivory tower, as I called it.
Yeah.
You just can't.
So I'm curious then, let's just talk about that, because I got to spend, you know, a few months in labor relations at GM way back in the 80s when I was a co-op student. And it was just very eye-opening. If no one's been in labor relations in a unionized environment, depending on the relationship. So did your way of conducting yourself as a labor relations manager, did it change the relationship with the union? Did it help from either a grievance standpoint or negotiations? Did you feel like it got some better results using that approach?
Yes. As we our grievance rate declined
mm-hmm.
Over because of communication.
Yeah.
And there was a trust element between
right.
myself and the chief steward
or the
business agent. When we got into the president of the union or something of that nature, well, he had to learn that.
Right.
And so I had to develop what was called, and I became famous for having a garden walk,
mm-hmm.
Where we could actually say, okay, let's put the cards on the table and have a talk about what in the heck is going on. You have a committee and they want this, and I have the interest of the company here, and I have a mandate.
Right.
So you had to clear that out, and you have to recognize that it has to end up being a win-win.
Yeah.
And win-lose never works.
No, not usually. I mean, it's a very short-term strategy. But this makes me think, and certainly I've seen it both with clients, but even I remember back in those GM days in the 80s, when you're dealing with someone who is used to a different way of having a relationship, you're almost breaking them in to the fact that we're going to have a different interaction than you're used to.
That's correct.
And I just wondered, do you have something that comes to mind where someone thought it was going to be a certain way, and over time you had to show them that it didn't have to be that way, and you changed the relationship from being a bit of win-lose to being win-win?
Well, I remember the first time and they went out on strike, and I met the individual with a baseball bat on the
They're circle. Carrying one, not you, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I had one in the trunk of my car.
So you got this power dynamic there, yeah. And then what did you do?
And we had to talk and get that thing put away because it was a threatening thing. And I said, we don't operate that way. So I want to get you back to work, yeah. And you want to get your people back to work, and we need to get back making money. Because strikes not good for anybody,
right?
And that was it was tense. Yeah. I'll have to say that because I had a large group of a large audience that was being infiltrated and infused with different ideas, yeah. And wording.
Yeah.
And so, but like anything else, that it just took time.
Yeah.
But once the time was there and the trust was there. We got back to the table and got back to work.
Yeah, that's really good to know. So again, what's coming through clearly, I'm sure our audience is realizing this, is that once you lay that bedrock of values and you're just persistent with it long enough, it wears people down in a good way because they realize that, well, this makes sense, right?
Yes.
I'm wondering, because over the years you would have had to have a lot of people reporting to you, especially as you got bigger. And I remember when you were getting close to the end of your career at the Window and Door Company, you and I had a discussion to say, it's going to take a few people to replace all the things that you're doing, which was true. So you had to build this team of other leaders. And I'm wondering either how did you instill the values? You must have had to deal with a few people over the years where their values didn't line up or they weren't really living them, and you probably had to make a decision that they weren't going to work out. I just wondered, how did you view that sort of from a development of those leaders to understand the importance of it, dealing with the fact that some of them may not have bought into that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I handpicked them all myself.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them came from other companies,
mm-hmm.
where I had worked.
Mm. So you knew them somehow or had someone vouch for them.
Or they worked, yeah. for me, or I worked for them.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And I assembled this team on the basis of the fact that I had been doing all of those functions. And I thought to myself, who do I see? And when I was walking around in the plant and in the office, and you look and you put a picture frame around somebody, and mm-hmm. you got a vision of a certain function,
yeah.
can that person fit into that, or can they move into it?
Right.
And I had these other faces come up in that picture frame. And so I went and talked to them, mm-hmm. and got them to join. And they were all still there when I left,
yeah.
Because they bought into.
And some of them are still there. Like I was looking it up because I knew I wanted to reach out to you, so I had to sleuth because you weren't there anymore. And you live pretty under the radar, which is why we're not really sharing a lot of contact info.
Right.
But mostly because you are retired and you don't have any interest in really doing that kind of work anymore. But yes, a lot of the same people are there, and I noticed that even the company got bought and bought again, so that just shows you the foundation there was successful enough to make the company attractive and retain some of these talented people over a long period of time.
Yeah.
10 years since you've been there,
yeah.
Right? So I think it's impressive, which again, for people that want to understand what the legacy of leadership is, it's really what happens when you're not around. And I don't just mean when you move on or retired, but just even when you're there, when you're not there, what's going on? Do people are still they're living those values? Do they still?
The legacy is in people, not in not in equipment.
Yeah, there we go. That's important. That's a good tagline. This is sort of related to what I was asking about your development of people, but let's say that you're giving advice to somebody who's younger and newer on their leadership journey, in some sort of an operations environment, manufacturing or operations. What would your suggestions be if they wanted to ultimately be successful, whatever that means, you know, have some career progress? What advice would you give to a younger person just trying to make their way?
Well, I found a fairly good success rate with my protocol. My guess would, and my advice would be, continue to invest in yourself, and in your own education, whether that be through self or advanced learning through university or college.
Yeah.
I think there's lots of good programs and good organizations around to teach leadership skills.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Buy books, practice. Practice and get feedback from other people on how they view what you're doing. But you have to set yourself your own mantra as to how you want to operate. The old saying I used to use was, who are you when no one is looking?
Yeah.
Right?
And it's actually a really good definition of leadership, of values, but even brands. Because brands are what customers think about you, right?
Right.
When you're not around to tell them about it. So I think all that is really incredible. Now, we didn't do a lot of business together. You were quite selective, I think, about when you would bring us in. I'm just curious, given that you did a lot of your own development work with your team, what made you decide to bring in someone from outside from time to time? And they were very specific things, but I never really asked you this because we didn't do like a lot of work all the time, but we did like these little strategic projects from time to time. And I just wondered what went through your mind to decide to bring an outsider in, whether it was us or someone else, versus just doing it yourself like you'd done a lot of it.
Yeah. There's a bunch of reasons. First of all, I there was time constraints on me because I was working.
And things were growing a lot.
Yeah. That was one of them. The second one was I didn't have the corner of the market of good ideas.
Yeah.
And I liked the infusion of new concepts coming into the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was the people had gotten to know me and my way.
Right.
And then I wanted them to see if there was another way and then expand on their education and their backgrounds on it.
Gotcha.
And it's part of development, and that was why I would do it. But those are the main reasons.
Yeah, actually, now that you say that, I remember probably being in your office once and saying, you know, you could probably teach whatever we're teaching. And it was true, but you just couldn't do everything. You couldn't do workshops and still, you know, keep the dealers' relationships going and buy the automation, all that. So thank you. Well, first of all, this has been great. I think that, again, anyone watching who's newer on their career path can say, wow, you know, this is just back to the fundamentals of being a good human being, having a strong sense of values and making sure that you live and demonstrate those values every day. So anyway, I just wanted to say thank you. Lauren Gerard, again, when I was working with him, ran a very large, rapidly growing window and door company that was quite successful and profitable, stewarded it to eventual sale, which was part of the succession planning. And that company is still successful. And the reason we're not naming names is just because Lauren's not looking for extra people to come and talk to him on stuff. So he's enjoying life that he's really earned. And just thank you for being here on the podcast.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to talk.
Yeah, it was really good. So again, thank you for watching the Accelerating Operational Performance podcast. Remember, if you want to tap into some of our expertise in growing more effective supervisors, managers, plant managers, team leaders, please reach out to us and start a conversation on our website at uniquedevelopment.com. For now, I'll just say best wishes for success on your leadership journey.